Hey, Getting in the Loop listeners. Wouldn't it be great if you could have more of a say about who I interview and the topics that we discuss? Well, now you can. I've created an easy way for you to tell me what you like and don't like about the Getting in the Loop podcast. Just head over to survey.gettinginthelooppodcast.com to take a quick survey about the Getting in the Loop podcast. Again, that's survey.gettinginthelooppodcast.com so you can shape the future of the Getting in the Loop podcast. Hi, I'm Katie Whelan, and join me each week as I talk with experts around the globe about circular economy. You'll find out what's being done to make it a reality, and if it can really solve the problems it promises. It's time for Getting in the Loop. Welcome back to the Getting in the Loop podcast. I'm Katie, and our guest today is Michelle Bowens of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. As the founder and director of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, Michelle works in collaboration with a global group of researchers in the exploration of peer production, governance, and property. He has published various books and reports, is a founding member of the Commons Strategy Group, and recently crafted a Commons transition plan for the city of Ghent in Belgium in 2017. This episode is a crash course in the commons economy. Michelle introduces me to the concept of peer-to-peer and how it can be used to create commons. We discuss how the concept of the commons can be used as a model for governance in the circular economy, and you'll also hear why Michelle is cautious of the so-called sharing economy, popularized by platforms such as Uber and Airbnb. Now on to today's show.
Well, Michelle, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today and to dive into what you have been working on. And to just get us started, could you give us a little bit of an idea of what is peer-to-peer?
Well, it's basically what we call a relational dynamic. So just imagine in a small village, less than 150 people, any problem you have, you can go to your neighbors and basically negotiate, discuss, and solve it, you know, with your peers, as it were. But it's something that didn't scale. So if we wanted to scale, we had to basically introduce hierarchy and keep down the cost of communication, coordination, etc. But now we have this network technology which allows small groups to form and to coordinate on a massive scale. So think about Linux as being, you know, this global complex free software project, but the average team is four people. So this is what is interesting to me, is the scaling up of this peer-to-peer relationship at a very high level of social complexity. And so this is what peer-to-peer is about. And then what you do with peer-to-peer is you can create commons. So you can not just communicate and organize yourself, but you can create shared value, and you can organize economic activities that are translocal, transnational, and that is of a high interest to the P2P Foundation.
Yeah, maybe you could say a little bit about the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. What is it, and your main aims and how you work?
Right. So basically, we use this a bit strange phrase. We peer produce knowledge about peer production. So we kind of see ourselves as a commons-oriented group, and we follow the same rules as open source communities. And we are basically, first of all, an observatory. So we look at how this relational dynamic is changing politics, business, spirituality, anything that you can find in society will have some kind of effect of this new possibility. And so, you know, it's like an onion. We have 13 people who are making a living today. So we have 10 researchers in a P2P lab, which is in northern Greece. We have a communications team, and I'm kind of more like have a nomadic existence. I spend 6 months of my time in Thailand with my family, and 6 months I'm on the road. And so I basically, you know, spend time talking to these communities, asking them how they work, visiting them, and creating, you know, more and more connections in this world. So we observe, we connect, but we also analyze and we form theories, you know, to frame our understanding.
And what you said earlier was that what you can do with peer-to-peer is to create commons. And when I was going through the material that you sent ahead of time, a lot of it's talking about a commons economy. I don't know if I have the, if is that the right terminology?
Yeah, well, we talk about commons economics, economy of the commons. So yes, so basically to understand that concept is that today, of course, we have a capitalist economy, which is centered around a particular form of the market. And the state serves the market, and civil society is a bit of a risk category. You know, it's what you do when you're tired and you come home after work. And so we believe that we can organize economies differently, centered around the commons. So think about an open source project. So at the core, you have an open contributive community where people can come in and out and produce free software code if they want to. But they have to make a living. So, you know, after a few years, they create what we call an entrepreneurial coalition around these shared resources. Think about Linux as free software. Mm-hmm. That's a commons. But around it, you have a huge Linux economy. And, you know, basically IBM is almost like a Linux consulting company nowadays. And then we have organizations. These organizations are a bit different from the traditional NGOs. So the Linux Foundation, the Wikimedia Foundation, the Drupal Association, they're organizations that take care of the infrastructure of cooperation, but they don't tell people what to do. Okay, so this is the micro scale. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we think this is also a new form of economy. So it's potentially a new system in the making, where you have a civil society that is now has to be considered productive because it's people are co-creating these shared resources everywhere. You have a economy around it, which is preferably what we call a generative economy or an ethical economy. So an economy that's not too extractive vis-a-vis these commons of nature and people. And then we have what we call partner state functions, which is basically ways in which cities and governments can facilitate, enable, empower, regulate these common-centric activities. I'll give you one example so you really understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Bologna, there is the Bologna Regulation for the Care and Regeneration of the Urban Commons. And so this is basically a protocol, you know, administrative regulation that allows the city to work together with communities who want to do something in the city. And, you know, the first year they had 30 projects, then 100, and the third year maybe 300. And now 150 cities in Italy are using these protocols, you know, to basically enhance the autonomy of civil society and their capacity to solve problems collectively.
Hmm. Okay, fascinating. Could you give an example of, like, a protocol? Like, what do these protocols look like?
Okay, I will give you a very silly example, but I think it spoke to my imagination, so I'll share it with you. Yeah. So there's this commons park in Ghent where I did a study. So in Ghent, they have 500 urban commons projects, and with a tenfold increase in 10 years, and we have verified these figures, so they're true for Italy, Spain, France, Belgium, Flanders, etc. Mm-hmm. So we have this enormous increase of urban commons projects since 2005. And they cover basically all provisioning systems, so shared mobility, shared housing, food provisioning, et cetera, et cetera. So here is a commons park. So that means that it's not a private park and it's not a public park. It's a group of neighbors that took over an old factory and said, well, you know, it's been empty for 10 years. Why don't we use it so our children can play and our, you know, old people can sit in the park and create connections between neighbors? And so after a few weeks, they had pigs. Now, if you are in the city and you see this, you say, well, this is, we can't allow this. It's not allowed for people to have pigs in the city, you know, out of animal welfare regulations. But what they did was they made a commons accord. They said, okay, if you promise us that you will take care of these pigs over time, we will allow you to have them. And so we'll sign an accord, right? So this is just a one-time accord between a community and the city. So what the regulation does is it allows us to do that at scale. So that once you have this regulation in place, every citizen with an initiative or every group of citizens with initiative can know but they can go to the city lab, explain their project, eventually get support, which doesn't have to be monetary support. There may be, you know, change regulation or suspend it for a while, or have the city come with, you know, their hygiene control or whatever. So basically you make an agreement between the city and the commons projects. And in Italy, they talk about the quintuple governance method, where you have the city, the chamber of commerce, the research organizations, the traditional NGOs, and all four of them organize themselves to support the fifth group, which is these commons projects, you know, sometimes called social innovation projects, but it's basically the same thing.
And when you were talking, I was listening to the different types of stakeholders that you were mentioning, and you talked about, you know, chamber of commerce, municipalities, citizens. But one of the groups that I hear are seemingly sort of absent is like these companies. So is this something that's not really related to companies, or how do companies fit into this idea?
They can. So basically the companies would work through the Chamber of Commerce or some kind of association of that kind, right? So it's because it's a governance model for the city, you can't privilege, you know, one company over another. So it has to be some kind of collective agency that represents the commercial sector. The companies would work through the Chamber of Commerce, and administrations would work through the city, and NGOs, you know, would work through this NGO kind of representation. And so they usually create these city labs, you know, so we have a commons lab in Antwerp, we have one in Sydney. So a lot more and more cities are organizing these city labs or commons labs to do exactly that. So to regulate the relationships between the city. And so since you mentioned companies, what you have to see is that you have, in the neoliberal system, we talk about public-private partnerships. And we are kind of critical of that because it actually excludes civil society. And here we have public commons or public social partnerships, but they can be extended. You can talk about public social private partnerships, right? But I think it's important to have the civic forces integrated because, you know, to be honest, I think we have a state failure and a market failure in terms of climate change and planetary resources. And then you have all these projects bottom up. They have very limited means, but they're actually achieving sometimes amazing things which companies cannot achieve. And I would like to give you an example. So if Uber integrates, introduces ride sharing in the city, they actually increase the traffic. The reason they do that is because they put all the drivers in competition with one another. And so in order to be at the right place at the right time, you know, the drivers tend to just drive around to be, you know, in the right place. If you have a car sharing association and you know that most cars are only used 4% of the time. So if you have 10% cars for 100% people, you have a doubling of the security margin. So you can guarantee full access to transport, and you have one car for 10 people, right? So in terms of, this is where it becomes interesting and related to the circular economy, is that by mutualizing these provisioning systems, for example, you know, you have shared mobility, every shared car in this system would replace 9 to 13 private cars. So first of all, you have an enormous advantage in ecological terms, like a, you know, 80% reduction in thermodynamic usage. Secondly, you need 90% less cars, so it's going to be much cheaper to do it. So it's socially inclusionary. And so combining both these social advantages and the ecological advantages, I think, is a very powerful mechanism to overcome our ecological crisis.
Actually, you mentioned circular economy, and of course, and then you gave Uber as this, you know, car sharing example, maybe a bad, yes. But like the negative consequences and the unintended like environmental impacts of that. How does like the commons economy compare to circular economy and the sharing economy in as sort of how it's been discussed recently in your eyes?
Well, the sharing economy is kind of a very confusing term because, you know, let's say Uber or Airbnb, they call themselves sharing, but there is no sharing. It's a renting mechanism, right? So this is not really sharing as people used to understand it. So I think the share economy myself is has been overused, has been, you know, like probably the circular economy and the sustainability. You know, all these terms can be hijacked basically by people who want to profit from these terms without really doing what's necessary. Then you have the circular economy, which of course is, you know, the idea of zero waste and reusing all the output as an input for another process. This is more, for me, the circular economy is more a technical term. And the commons economy is about governance. So a circular economy theoretically could take many forms. And one of the forms is that a circular economy could use the commons as a governance mechanism in order to achieve much more of these advantages. And I want to give you an example where, you know, how this is happening, maybe not to our satisfaction, but it's an interesting development. If you look at the blockchain projects, they are open source. They are based on contributive principles, so people can come in and out of the ecosystem. So what you have in the blockchain economy, ideally, is a shift from a system that's based purely on individual competition to a vision of collaborative ecosystems. Mm. Now, they're still very market-oriented. There's still lots of design issues because it has a kind of libertarian philosophy. But you could commodify, as it were, the blockchain principles and say, okay, instead of commodity currencies, we could use mutual credit and asset-backed currencies. Instead of smart individual contracts, we could use collective Ostrom contracts, as we call them. So we could look at the principles behind the blockchain and transform them into a more social direction. And then we would have an infrastructure that can be used to organize a circular economy. So that's a potential scenario that we are working on.
Yeah, it makes me think of Kate Raworth. I'm going to pronounce her name.
Raworth. I think it's Raworth.
Yes.
Yes, I know her. She's a friend of mine. We know her. She actually wrote the foreword of our last report.
Yes, I was going to say she wrote the foreword because I took a look at that. You guys met on the Eurostar just recently,
yes,
or at least.
Amazing. Yeah. So you have to imagine this, right? I'm waiting in line for the customs. And somebody ticks me on the, you know, amongst the thousands of people waiting in line, somebody is just behind me ticks me on the shoulder. So what are the odds of that?
Yeah.
We had to meet.
Chance encounter, yeah. But and I don't know if this is in her book or if it's based on a presentation that I saw her give or via Ken Webster, who was on the podcast on episode, I believe it's number 4, but we had a little bit of this discussion about decentralized versus the centralized circular economy. And I keep kind of finding this a bit fascinating because I would imagine that a more decentralized circular economy is sort of more in line with like the commons economy.
Of course. So what we say is it's not just decentralized. Basically, we talk about open contributive systems, right? So basically, a system like in free software, every coder who wants to can work on the Linux code. And so this now works for software knowledge and design. And basically, what we would like is to bring this down to actual material production. So to have much more freedom and mutual coordination in the sphere of material production. So imagine an ecosystem to produce organic food in which all farmers and all consumers could join in if they wanted to. This is kind of our ideal. So it's not controlled by any vertical company. It's a system that creates a collaboration field for various companies, various collectives, various citizens, various consumers, and eventually with, you know, some regulatory role for local and national or even global institutions. So the idea is, I would like to describe you the scenario of my last report. Is that okay for you?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. So basically what we imagine is a three-level economy. So in free software, we talk about stick merging. It's a difficult word, but it's basically means coordination through signals. It's basically what bees do, right? They dance and then they tell their other bees where they should be going to find pollen. So there's no queen telling all the bees what they should do. It's the bees are always communicating with each other, peer to peer. And this is what free software coders do when they work on Linux or other free software projects. They may work for IBM, they may work for Red Hat, they may be freelancer, they may just want to solve any issue on their own without even being paid. But they all work together in this meta system. And they know what to do because they can see what everybody else is doing. So it's like playing a soccer match, but at a huge scale, right? Mm-hmm. That we talked about this in the beginning. So this is the third level. You know, the more companies are willing to share logistics, supply chain information, you know, through shared distributed accounting systems, the more the economy can adapt to each other. So why should I make more shoes if I know there's already an overproduction of shoes, for example, right? Second level is what I call generative markets. So markets that don't extract too much from the people creating the value, but actually make communities thrive and take into account of material resources. And I'll give you one example. So Fishcoin is a project for intelligent crypto that tells you how much fish can be taken out of the ocean without endangering their reproduction. So this is, you know, people are free, but their money tells them something, right? They tell them that maybe they shouldn't buy more fish right now because they're in danger of going over the limit of the reproduction rate. So the third level is basically a kind of a level of regulation. So imagine that you have a global thresholds and allocations council, basically a group of scientists that would determine, you know, resource levels. Basically, you know, how much copper can we use, cobalt can we use without exceeding planetary boundaries. And so this would be kind of a regulatory function. So it's not a top-down mechanism whereby an authoritarian state, you know, tells you exactly what to do. The idea is more to have, you know, kind of a planetary protection mechanism, and then all the human entities would know through their shared logistics and shared accounting system what in their context is the sustainability effort they should be making, right? So within that, you're completely free to produce and consume, but you need to take into account basically the harm towards the planet. So this is, in a way, kind of a synergy between mutual coordination, which is the commons way, regenerative markets, so it includes the best of the market, and a kind of facilitating state function, right? An institution for the common good. And so this, in our last report, which is called P2P Accounting for Planetary Survival, we describe projects that are actually already doing this. So we don't see this as a purely utopian vision. We see it as something that's already kind of available in seed form. But what we do with the P2P Foundation is, because we take this meta view, we can, you know, try to make the puzzle ourselves and say, well, if you do this and this and this and this together, you actually have a new logic and a new system.
Could you share some of one or two examples from this report? I will link it in the show notes so that listeners can go and read it, of course. But
right. Yeah, so the idea of a global thresholds and allocation council is from a project called Global Reporting 3.0. So that's one of the projects we discuss. What I really like is a project called Region Network. So this I want to briefly explain. I think it's a very powerful model. So let's assume you want to achieve decarbonization in agriculture. So basically what you create is what they call an ecological state protocol, is, you know, what the society, what the industry wants to achieve and needs to achieve. And then all citizens, all groups, all collectives, cooperatives, companies, everyone can really say, I did this. And you have a verification mechanism with a, you know, like a blockchain kind of distributed ledger So this is a verification mechanism. And then you have a tokenization. And basically the tokens get funded by all the institutions and companies that profit from this positive ecological externality. And I think this is a very powerful way to improve on public procurement, which is always a winner-take-all system. And what you often get is, in order to win a contract, you know, you kind of externalize everything else so you can focus on being the cheapest in achieving one particular thing. But it basically precludes any holistic or integrated system thinking in solving problems. But in this system that we are proposing, inspired by Region Network, what you have is a mechanism which can basically mobilize the whole society. And so can also fund everyone. And I think this is important. So we call this circular finance, inspired by circular economy, because, you know, the more regenerative economy activities people do, you know, the more they get funded. And so that solves a very important problem that, generative activities are rarely funded in our system.
Mm. So, and it's not just about individual like actions, but also sort of how they link to the whole. Because I'm thinking, because a lot of times in a circular economy, you're trying to get things back at, you know, after use or at the end of life. And one of the difficulties that a lot of companies say is, well, we don't see our products again. We don't see any exactly. of that. So why should we actually yeah. design things to be remanufacturable? Because we're not the ones getting, this maybe sort of solves that a little bit.
Yes, yes. And I was just reading about another project, which unfortunately is not in our report because it wasn't really operating when we wrote it, and that's a criterion for us. But there's this project called Materium, which basically wants to, you know, to make intelligent consumer objects, right? And once you get that, you would have actually a full system of logistics that integrates both production and consumption, because that's the weak point. I mean, you know, industry is very efficient. But then, as your friends say, once it gets into the consumer hands, it's a black box. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, so it's really an issue, I think, of, you know, puzzling intelligently together solutions that would reinforce each other, right? And that together would make a whole new system. Individually, they're just part of the solution. And they can be part of what's called the Jevon paradox, which is, you make something more efficient like light bulbs, but you end up allowing more people to get light bulbs. So you lose the advantage to the consumption. Mm. And so that's why we need to work, you know, what we call integrally, is to have always the whole system in mind.
Yes, I think that's the paradox is quite famous. I also find it in my research when looking at companies who are trying to incentivize secondhand or take back and things. And a lot of the ways that they do it is they take back products, but then they're saying, oh, here's a discount for buying a new product since you gave us your old one. And I'm like, that's not reducing consumption. Is this reducing consumption? I don't think so. So
yes, that happens quite often. And this really needs to be solved. Otherwise we are not making any progress.
Yeah. So I was curious, what are sort of the typical responses to the commons economy, because I imagine there might be some critiques if you're talking about anytime you try to do something in a different way, there's always people who are opposing you. So I'm curious, what is the response? And
it's often a question of language. You know, it's often a question of language, and I don't know if you will believe me, but already, you know, just talking about commons instead of other C words or S words is already going to solve a lot of reactions, right? Because, people have an understandable fear of totalitarian systems. But here we're talking about voluntary cooperation and mutual coordination. So this kind of relaxes already. For example, a lot of people would be, you know, ideologically completely watch to market solutions, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not saying abolish the market. We are saying transform the market. And I think a lot of people in business actually know that, that this is, you know, that they need to do this. Another critique what we might get is that it's too technocentric. And this is kind of a, you know, critique that we reject because we always talk about socio-technical systems. So we always pay a lot of attention to the social side. So it's not just the technology that will solve anything. It's basically a technology, but in the context of new social choices. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I was also curious about that because a lot of the solutions that you mentioned are focused, you know, on technology. So, yeah.
Yes, but my answer is that everything is technology, that, you know, we are a technological species and we use, you know, we use spears and sticks and from the very beginning of our humanity. So it's not a question for me of, you know, more technology or not. It's like, what technology, right? And what's the right level of technology and what's the right level of complexity, etc. So I think it's a fake debate if you say, you know, you're against technology, because even if you're against it, you're just going to use another technology. Another critique I take a bit more seriously is an issue of inclusion, social inclusion. Because, for example, when you look at urban commons and urban gardens, you know, very often it's more like the cognitive class. Thomas Piketty speaks about the merchant right, the Brahmin left, and those who have neither. And so basically, you know, there's a lot of people now working in the cognitive economy. A lot of them are precarious, but they have high cultural capital. And so the level of self-organization that's required, especially when technical systems are involved, is, you know, is substantial and in a way privileges, quote unquote, you know, the people who are more culturally rich in a certain sense. So you have to pay a lot of attention when you do commons to look at this issue of diversity and inclusion. But what I noticed when I studied in Ghent is that you also have another commons, which is an ethnic and religious commons. And so there is a paradox that the people with civic commons, who are in theory universalistic and open to everyone, you know, end up having a kind of more of an elite membership. And the people who are ideologically obviously close because it's a commons only for their ethnic group or their religious group, in practice attract more poor people. So this is kind of a contradiction or a paradox that I think it would be probably good to solve in some way to make these people collaborate more. And there is a French scholar whose name escapes me right now, Genevieve, that's all I remember. And she's trying to establish a convergence between Ostrom and Amartya Sen. So basically she talks about commons of capabilities. And so there are 8 rules that determine a commons that were established by Eleanor Ostrom. And she adds 3 more to identify whether a particular commons is, you know, inclusive or not, basically. So I think there's work that can be done in that field.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. I'm going to have to look up that.
It's Geneviève Fontaine. It came back to me.
Maybe I could. Maybe you can send the name to me because I don't think I'll be able to spell that properly. Yeah. At least
I will. Yeah.
Thanks. When I was looking at the report of peer-to-peer accounting for planetary survival, one of the things that kind of stuck out a little bit when I was skimming it was about new forms of licensing. I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about this, because maybe it's not so applicable, but I'm a little bit interested in this because right now I'm producing and selling a physical board game called In the Loop. So I recognize this is very much like old thinking, but I've been thinking about ways to potentially make it open to everyone, like such as through a print and play. So I was just curious to hear your thoughts about like what kinds of licensing models do you see as promising going forward, and maybe even particularly for the game.
Yes, so what we advocate is a kind of a new type of license. So the two old licenses are, in a way, the capitalistic and the communistic license. So copyright says, you know, this is my property, and without my permission and paying me, you cannot use this, right? Mm-hmm. And copyleft just says the opposite. This is open for everyone. And these open licenses, they work very well for immaterial commons, like free software, knowledge, Wikipedia, etc. And they work well because immaterial goods are non-rival or anti-rival, which means that, you know, if I use your software, you still have your software, right?
Yeah.
So it actually gains value the more it is used. But the problem with it is that it does favor, in the free software economy, it does favor big companies, because big companies like IBM can come in and can then use the free software. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it gives, you know, they give a lot of jobs to a lot of software developers. So in general, free software developers are not unhappy with the state of things. But imagine you are a co-op and you're actually doing a design for machinery or for products. It's a bit different, because in this particular context, you're going to think, well, if I share this completely, some big company is going to take it, and they are going to have much more money to invest in their machinery than we have. And they're going to outcompete us, and we need to pay, you know, raw material, people, place, etc., etc. So what we propose here is what's called reciprocity-based licensing. And basically what you do is you separate the knowledge from the commerce. So what we say is, if you are using our knowledge to share the knowledge, that's fine. But if you are using our knowledge to create a commercial strategy, then you need to show that you give something back to that commons. I can give you an example,
yeah.
A very simple example. It's unfortunately, it's not a product, but it's it's actually a paradox. It's a license, but okay, because you'll get the principle. It's called a Fair Shares Association. It's an English association that comes out of the solidarity economy and that has created a new form of property that is based on four types of ownership: funders, founders, workers, and users. And I think this is a very good initiative. But here's what they say. If you want to share our knowledge, you can use Creative Commons non-commercial. But if you want to use it yourself in your company, then you need to become a member of our association. You need to pay $300 a year, and you get a Creative Commons commercial license. So this interplay of these two is actually what we mean. It's a demand for reciprocity. Does that make sense? I hope so.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to even use the Creative Commons, like the share alike and those kinds of things, where it's like kind of like the reciprocity in terms of if...
Yes, but the problem with the normal free software licenses are the reciprocity is only on the knowledge, right?
Mm.
So imagine you are an indigenous community in Ecuador and you have these special herbs, right? And these scientists come to help you, and then in the worst case, you know, they do biopiracy. So they actually patent your knowledge. You have nothing.
Yeah.
But in the second alternative, an open license, you still have nothing, right? The indigenous people would still not get anything, because it would be other people would use that open knowledge. And it's only if you have that third type of license where you say, well, if you use our knowledge, you have to give something back.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in that case they would effectively get something, you know, that would recompense their efforts. So that's the idea.
Yeah. Do you see it being done for like actual physical things? Or as you said, a lot of it is about intangible, immaterial goods.
Yes. So far, there's one for mobility in France. I don't know too much about the details, but I keep a list of them. But so far, yes, it's not really yet. I haven't really seen any for machines or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But maybe I've seen it for services.
Yeah, for services. Okay. Yeah, maybe in the future. Well, it's given me some food for thought. I'm conscious of the time. And before we go, I would love to ask you the question that I ask all of the interview guests who come on the podcast, which is about the game, the In the Loop game that I created. So it's a board game, and it's about, in the game, you're a manufacturing company and you have to produce a product, and you are trying to navigate your supply chain, essentially. And it's a little bit difficult because there's different market conditions, and the market conditions change in the game, and they're inspired by, sometimes even by, real world happenings. So what I ask the interviewees is if they could create an event for the game, what kind of event would that be? And normally interview guests link it to sort of their vision for the future. So I don't know if you have any ideas for what kind of,
So in the P2P Foundation, we are moving from the Netherlands to Ghent, where our chairperson is called Evie Swinnen, and she directs the Time Lab, which is a very active cultural center in Ghent, and they have a School of the Commons there. So I think you should talk with Evie and organize some event in Ghent.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds like a plan. We can do that. Where can listeners, is there a way that my listeners can get involved with the Peer-to-Peer Foundation?
Yes, we have a wiki. So that's wiki.p2pfoundation.net, where we have a very extensive library of 22,000 articles on all topics related to peer-to-peer and the commons. Like, we have one on commons economics, we have one on urban commons, we have one on commons policymaking. We have one on the circular economy. We have one on sustainable manufacturing. We have one on what we call cosmo-local production. You know, you would be surprised. Most of your listeners wouldn't know that there are 400, you know, peer-to-peer accounting projects ongoing. So lots of things are happening, you know, weak signals that are not reproduced in the press, in the mainstream press. And this is what we do. We follow the things that other people don't follow. So we also have a blog. It's blog.p2pfoundation.net. This is more like a newspaper, you know, two items per day, the most important things that we think you should know. I do a lot of curation on Facebook. It's called Open P2P. And we have a Twitter account, P2P Foundation, and also one called MBowens. So yeah, we are pretty good in the digital networking field, and there's... So if you want to know anything about this topic, you'll find your way.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For show notes and links, go to our website at gettinginthelooppodcast.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list to have new episodes delivered to your inbox every Monday. See you next week.